Before we get to this episode, just to say thanks to everyone who's bought my new book, Champion Thinking, How to Find Success Without Losing Yourself. Published by Bloomsbury, the response has been terrific. It's an Amazon bestseller. It's been top 20 in the airport charts consistently, and the reviews have been terrific right across the board. And if you like this episode that you're about to hear on Flow, you'll be sure to enjoy Champion Thinking. Head to my website, simonmundy.com, or Amazon, Waterstone, Smith's, places like that, to get your copy.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Don't Tell Me the Score, the podcast that uses sport to explore life's bigger questions. My name is Simon Mundy, and each week I sit down with an expert, from the biggest sporting names in the world to Buddhist monks, neuroscientists, psychologists, and philosophers. We discuss a theme that tells us something insightful and important about life and how best to live it, from the importance of self-acceptance to facing addiction and developing resilience, right through to getting your circadian rhythms in sync and how to sleep better. Sport is a metaphor for life, and in this podcast, I aim to prove that right. I always like hearing from you, so the best way to get in touch is via my website, simonmundy.com, or I'm at Simon Mundy on social media. In this episode, I'm talking to the Olympic gold medal winning hockey player, Alex Danson, and the theme is no regrets. Alex Danson, how are you?
Good, thank you. Thank you very much for having me here today.
Absolute pleasure. I was slightly expecting to see you in sunglasses and that pink Patagonia hat that you've been rocking for ages.
Thankfully, I'm a lot better than I was even a few months ago. I still have headaches a lot, but I'm not quite as sensitive to the light. So my lovely hat and sunglasses don't need to be donned at all times.
You're back with the GB squad. I don't want to talk too much about it, but just, yeah. So you're clearly very much on the mend from your traumatic brain accident.
Yeah, it's absolutely. For me, I felt like I'd got to the stage in my recovery where getting back to some normality, returning to the team, trying to kind of improve the last parts of my health, being back in an environment I knew was really important. So yeah, it's fabulous to be back there.
Feeling optimistic and grateful?
Very, very grateful. It's wonderful to have the opportunity to try. And it's also wonderful to have the opportunity to...
Oh, there goes my chair. Carry on.
to just give my health the opportunity to improve to where it was previous to my prior to my injury.
Okay, we're going to talk about your injury. We're going to talk about what you've learned. We've got to start with your outstanding hockey career. So you are one of Britain's greatest ever hockey players. I like that. The coy grin.
Sounds like a biased mum or brother kind of thing to say.
Yeah, well, over 300 caps. How many in total?
306.
I'm always amazed by how many caps hockey players get. Yeah. I had Kay Richardson Walsh on. I was like, yes, that's so many.
And actually, we play even more games now. So I think the players coming through now will gain even more caps because kind of how regular international calendar is now, it's incredible, really.
And you're an absolute goal machine, weren't you?
I don't know about goal machine.
You broke the record.
I was a forward. I think
100 goals.
Yeah, I think.
Listen, if you're going to come on, I'm not having you being coy and downplay it, all right?
Okay, my job is to score goals, I guess. So, thankfully I had great players behind me and players alongside.
Here we go. Oh,
we could score a lot of goals between us.
I saw a video of you actually where you're doing like this, you probably know the one I mean, where you're doing this leap sideways and hitting it inside out and scoring. Do you know the video I mean?
I think it was with. Yeah, I think
acrobatic.
Investor did that. Yeah, it was. So I guess my you know, my trademark is I was probably on the floor more than I was standing up. I wasn't afraid to throw myself about, and I love the athleticism of the game. So, I mean, that was probably a rare one where I actually made contact with the ball. There's many where I missed.
Olympic gold medalist. So you've reached the peak of the hockey world.
Yeah, Rio was, God, so spectacular. It was for me, not the fact that it was obviously an Olympic Games, which is the pinnacle of, you know, for any sport. But it was the manner in which we did it. It was just relentless monotony, game by game, doing the same thing very simply, all together as a team. And it kind of culminated in that win, which was, something that I can always look back very proudly at.
Yeah, I spoke to Kate about it and the journey that you guys had, and there'd been that tournament where you really underperformed, and then you all got together, had these tough conversations, and I mean, it's movie script esque, really, the way you got to that goal, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was certainly, you know, it wasn't plain sailing at all. We went into that tournament ranked seventh in the world, the underdogs. No one expected us to win, but we believe we could. But that doesn't happen. You can't just put a group of people in a room and say, you know, believe you're going to win and you will. That has to be backed up with your behaviours prior to that. That has to be backed up by where you fit in the team, by the people that you're surrounded with, by the support staff. So it was the journey we went on.
Yeah.
Absolutely was the only reason that we ended up, you know, winning that gold medal on the behalf of everybody that had played for our team.
That's exactly what Kate said. It's representing everyone and the people who played and didn't make the team or whatever. But also you said about the preparations, and they all feed into the beliefs, don't they? And actually, when you do believe that you can achieve something, then, you know, magical stuff is possible.
It does. It changes your behaviour. If you believe you can do something, fundamentally, your behaviour will change. Because if you can believe you can do it, you'll go out and practice, or you'll go out and train, or you'll have that difficult conversation with someone that you wouldn't ordinarily. But because you have this unwavering, you know, underlying belief in whatever it is you want to achieve, you change what you do. It's almost was as simple as that for us.
Not only do you have a gold medal, you've got a pitch named after you at your school.
Yeah, that was
cool.
That was really special. Yeah, so my old school, I mean, there was never an Astro when I was at school. I was kind of gutted when they were like, oh, we're building an Astro. I was like, oh, it's 20 years too late. But it's a fabulous facility, and I actually didn't know they were naming it after me, so they asked if I'd go along to the pitch.
Did you cut the ribbon?
I did, I cut the ribbon, but I turned up and my PE teacher was there, and many of the staff I used to know, and there was this big kind of Alex Stanton hockey pitch, which was really lovely. Yeah, yeah, it was very special.
Last year I was on the panel to choose the Young Sports Personality of the Year Award. Alumni?
Yeah.
So you won it like way back when?
So I think it was the first year.
Was it?
I think it was the first year, and it was, goodness me, BBC Sports Personality was so different. It was in a private studio.
Yeah.
There was, my mum and dad came. You know, I don't think I'd ever even brushed my hair, and they did my hair. It was amazing. I met David Beckham. You know, you were in a room, and as I said, a very personal room with like the best of the best athletes, and I was just an absolute starstruck kid. But yeah, that was, I feel kind of, it's really special looking back at that, actually, having, you know, been to many sports personalities now. Obviously seen how much it's changed, how much sport's grown here. You know, it's much more of an event. But yeah, that was a really amazing evening back.
I used to love Spotty. I mean, like, I love Spotty now, but I used to love it back in the day, because it was over in Shepherd's Bush, wasn't it?
Do you know, it's so long ago, I can't even remember.
It was here in London.
It was here in London, probably. Yeah, in London.
Before they took it on the road. And you've played for Britain since you were 16. Unbelievable. Now, here, quick question, because I was reading about, well, what do you say your best characteristic is? Would you, and I put words in your mouth here, would you say it is, you know, your drive and your character?
Oh, 100%. I have always fundamentally believed the most talented aren't the most successful. It's the ones that work the hardest. And, you know, I remember as a youngster, I think it was our first under 16 team. We had a bleep test, and I got level like 10.1, very average. Played hockey, was absolutely terrible. But we were all invited back for a trial about 6 weeks later, and I knew we were going to do the bleep test again. And goodness, I woke my poor mum and dad up every morning to go running. I think every morning thought, oh, she won't come this morning. And I'd knock on the door, and they'd be like, oh. And went back, and I got level 13.9 or something on the bleep test. Went to play hockey, still terrible, but I was picked that year. And I think it taught me the most valuable lesson in that, you know, particularly as a youngster, you can be taught the skills. You can hopefully teach somebody to have the right mentality, but without a shadow of a doubt, the hardworking. You know, I've never missed a session in my life. I've been so diligent by the way I've lived my career. I believe that's why I've had a long career, because I've looked after my body and I've done everything to the letter. And I'm really proud I've lived my career in that way.
I've heard a lot of coaches say they'd much rather coach someone who has that drive and determination than someone who's chock full of talent but doesn't have that.
If I ever have the opportunity to coach, I might be a terrible coach because I'll pick on character and not talent. So I'll probably have these wonderful people that are really rubbish at hockey. But I would always pick on character. I'd pick a team where you want to learn, you're coachable. Obviously, you know, you have to be talented. There has to be a level of talent there, but the qualities that you can have in someone's personality, mindset, character, for me, they're the hidden extras. And I think that's what we've had in abundance over the last few years in our team.
And anyone can work on that stuff, because that's all just application, decision, skill. You know, it's things you can improve.
Absolutely. And, you know, application is key. It's about how you do your daily things day in, day out, every day. And sometimes they're boring. Sometimes they're relentless. They're not. I think particularly in our world, there's this probably misconception that it's, you know, quite a glamorous, amazing, you know, you're playing sport, but actually all that's ever seen is that shop window of a tournament, which does look amazing. What you don't see is, you know, the early morning trainings, the training in the rain, the physical sessions where you're thrown up, you know, the hard conversation you're having to have amongst teammates, you know, not going on holiday, choosing to do different things. It's
sacrifice,
amazing.
Yeah,
but then again, for me, sacrifice is a choice. Yeah. So it's what are you willing to make a choice of? What is it that you want to do, and how are you willing to give everything to try and achieve that? And for me, I think that's why I've loved playing. It's never felt like a sacrifice. It's always felt like a really good choice.
So had you not dragged mum and dad out of bed to go running in preparation for that second bleep test, things might have turned out quite differently.
Yeah, I also think you have pivotal moments in your life where you learn really valuable lessons. And for me, that was that the coach back then, honestly, I 100%, people won't believe me, I was the worst player by a country mile. I was really scrawny. I wasn't very strong. I hadn't developed in terms of skills, but that coach just saw that application in me, that I was willing to go and work hard, that I was willing to, you know, I was pretty much saying, I'll work hard for you, teach me the skills. I will do whatever you ask me to do. You can give me all the bits that I can't yet do. And yeah, it was a massive lesson. I think it had a massive impact on my career because that's how I always lived it. I never expected anything in my career, ever. And I remember every tournament I've ever been to, I've never ever thought I may get picked, because as soon as you have expectation, again, it affects your behaviour. Mm-hmm. So my expectation's always been low and the outcome's always been great. So it's just how you think of things. And I think that probably came from the lesson I learnt when I was 16.
That reminds me of an equation I heard someone say once. It's like happiness is reality minus expectation or something like that. That really resonated with me.
Yeah.
You know, if you set
and
the bar.
It's just sometimes just tweaking how you think has a massive impact on how you feel, and how you feel has a massive impact on how you behave, therefore how much you enjoy something.
Yeah.
And that's very much how I've lived my career.
And you've definitely learned a lot about that over the last couple of years as well. And so the graph that you had then to get up and drag mum and dad out and that month, where does that graph come from, and to what role have your parents played in developing that side of you?
Yeah, my parents have been, you know, absolutely crucial to...
Can't have been spoiled.
No, definitely not spoiled. But to me as a person, to you know, definitely as a sports person, but as a human as well. You know, my dad worked incredibly hard, as did my mum when we were growing up. My dad would be out before, you know, before we were up for school even, and then back later. And he always said to us, you know, always work that little bit harder than is expected of you. That was always... it was always something that was kind of enforced. And, well, not enforced, we just saw that in Dad, and that's how we behaved. And with Mum, exactly the same. And Mum found enjoyment in so many things that we all did together and never pushed any of us. It was a case of, you know, what do you enjoy doing? Well, the harder you try at something, the more that you will kind of reap that reward. And that was very much how we were brought up. But it was in a really comfortable environment. So I think you learn so much from your parents that at the time you don't really realise that you are. You don't realise that you're subconsciously picking up these traits that you see in your mum and dad.
Yeah, it's that modelling side of things, isn't it? Rather, it's like what they do, not what they say.
Exactly. It was never necessarily what they say. I saw my dad working hard. I saw my mum enjoying what we do and spending all of her time with us. You know, I saw these things and it influenced how I therefore behaved. And goodness, they gave us so much opportunity. Mum and Dad would drive us here, there and everywhere. They would, you know, get up early to go running. They would take us to late training sessions. You know, we just had the opportunity. And for that, you know, I'll always be forever grateful, because I, you know, definitely wouldn't have had this career had it not been for them.
So supportive but not pushy. That's the key parenting ethos.
100%. I think it was really easy. I even look back now at some players that I played with that were so talented, but I actually think their parents wanted it more than them.
Mm.
And as soon as that balance is not in, you know, tipped the wrong way, your chances of being successful is so much harder. It has to.
It's
come
damaging.
From, it has to come from you. It has to come from the. It had to come from me, and it did came from me. But they gave me every opportunity when I said I will try. If you know, I will do this, therefore, you know, we'll do whatever we can to make sure you can.
Yeah. I've had a few people on the pod who definitely their parents were sort of pushing and wanted it to do for them, and actually it did leave sort of scars and could even lead to sort of mental health issues and that kind of thing. If you're doing something for someone else, that's a problem.
And I think you know, sometimes now I want more opinion from my mum and dad, but they even now they very much support me to make my own decision. And often when I've made my decision, they're like, "Oh, I'm really glad you made that one." It's like, "Why didn't you tell me?" They're like,
"Oh, great parents.
You know, you had to come to that decision yourself." And I'm really grateful for that. And it's probably not until I've got to this stage in my career where I've realised how influential that's been on my path.
Yeah, that's helped you obviously develop your own intuition and trust yourself more.
Absolutely. And learn to make my own decisions, knowing they're supported and knowing they'll tell me afterwards either way whether they think it was right or wrong.
Yeah, that's great. So I read a quote of yours where you said the most exciting part of being an athlete is that you'll never finish. You're always looking to make something better. So always striving to improve.
I think that's single-handedly been the reason I've played as long as I have, because you're just never done. And I love that every day my life has complete purpose. Every day I am making decisions based upon becoming a better athlete, whether it's eating, whether that's sleeping, whether that's, you know, goodness, the first 15 years of my career, I didn't really go on a long holiday. I mean, I did go on a holiday and that didn't end well, so maybe it was safe that I didn't go on a, you know, I made every decision was around being in the best shape when I went back into training on the Monday morning. Mm-hmm. And what could I do that would make the team stronger, or how could we think more differently to move this team forward?
Mm.
And it was just like it's been an endless dialogue in my brain, and I've enjoyed that. I like looking for ways to be better, and in sport, and I think in many careers, you know, I look at fabulous, you know, role models away from sport, and they're the people that are always looking to improve.
Mm.
And
a never-ending quest, isn't it?
It's a never-ending quest. You know,
you're never the finished product.
We won in Rio. We weren't the finished product. You know, the next day, you're on to defending the next title, and it's just a really exciting and, you know, great environment to live in.
Making those decisions to improve. Obviously, anyone out there, everyone has to make these decisions, and some of us are better at doing them consistently than others. Obviously, you were very committed to making them consistently. Do they kind of snowball? Do you know what I mean? Like, they become increasingly easy to make the right decision the more you make them?
Yeah, I do believe that, you know, the famous quote, excellence becomes a habit. I do think the hardest thing is to start. When you set yourself a goal, the hardest part is doing it for the first few days. And after the first few days, it becomes to be part of your routine. It becomes to be almost enjoyable because you start to see the rewards, whether that's health-related or work-related, or in my example, it's sports-related. The exercise becomes easier, or your results become better. And therefore, making good decisions become easy. Now, I do look back to the start of my career when we didn't win much, and I think, how did I do it back then? But that's when you go back to belief and what you want to achieve. And I believe goal setting is probably the number one most important thing for my life, because if I don't have something that I'm striving towards or something that I believe in achieving, how does it affect what I do every day? And I had that even from 16. I knew I wanted to be a part of a winning team. So for the first few years of our career, when we didn't win much, we were ranked much lower, I played, you know, 15 minutes in a game, touched the ball 3 times, I still had this goal. I still had this drive to be part of a winning team. So you learn as you go through a journey. It may not be a 6-week target, it may be a 16-year, but you just chip away at it slowly.
Mm.
And yes, I appreciate it's very easy for me to say this, given that, you know, you can look back and I have achieved that ultimate goal of winning with the team in Rio. But it hasn't finished. There are still other things. So even if you don't quite achieve what it is that you're after, the journey I've been on is fabulous. The winning in Rio was amazing, but it wasn't necessarily the best part of my career. It was going through my career and learning all the things I did along the way and enjoying that endless goal. That was the best part of my career.
Mm. Yeah, everyone who's mega successful has said exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
It's, you know, you'd swap the kind of stepping up to get the trophy for the bits that's gone before.
Exactly. That sums it up perfectly. And actually, the best parts of my career, no one will ever see. Mm-hmm. Because they're not the bits that are put on television. They're the moments in a changing room. They're the moments on the side of the pitch. It's the friendships that you have for the rest of your life. It's the moments when you failed and you shouldn't have failed and you didn't want to fail, but you did. And what that did to the relationships that you held with the people that happened with, or it's those things that are valuable.
Mm-hmm.
And again, as I said, it's very difficult because we did have that ultimate success, but my favourite parts are not just that moment.
Mm. It's a cliche, isn't it? Focus on the process, not the goal. But actually, I mean, that it's not said without reason, you know?
It's
backed up by people's experience like you, and you've reached the very top of your profession. Now, you've spoke about your dodgy relationship with holidays. So, so let's move on to the dodgiest holiday you've been on.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I don't know what else happened, but so there you were, you and your now husband, Alex, who's a bit of a hero.
Yeah.
Well, apart from at this moment when he landed you right in it.
Yeah.
So there he was. So there you are. Set the scene and just tell us what happened.
So we'd literally just come off the back of a home World Cup. It was amazing. Alex had kind of persuaded me, as I said, I never like to take a holiday, particularly persuaded me that we needed a nice holiday. We were going to go to Kenya, you know, holiday in a lifetime. We were going on safari. And I remember one evening we were sat and we just had dinner and I was kind of sat leaning into a brick wall. And Alex was next to me and, you know, he told a joke. And everyone asked what this joke was. Goodness, we cannot remember. But he told some joke or said something that really made me laugh. And I kind of flung my whole body forwards, kind of holding my belly. And I flung my head back at like a reasonably, you know, good speed. And I just hit the back of my head like flush on a wall. And I mean, we both at the time, it made this horrendous thud. It hurt. And I have to say, I knew straight away something wasn't quite right. But we both kind of awkwardly, he was like, oh, Al, are you okay? I was like, oh, that really hurt. Kind of rubbed it. We kind of, you know, carried on. We went back. We were heading back to where we were staying anyway. And the next morning I woke up and I kind of knew I wasn't right because I woke up every hour during the night, but I kind of ignored it. I said, let's go out for a run. So we went out and did some training and I was like, oh, I'm fine. Yeah, I haven't got a concussion again. I've had it 3 times before.
So you got through the run okay?
So I got through the run okay, but then I came back and went into our room and just it completely, everything spun and I felt terrible. And then I was like, okay. And I remember saying to Al, you know, I've got a mild concussion. I need to take it easy. I'd experienced it before. I kind of knew the symptoms. We were still in Kenya for 2 or 3 more days. We took it very easy. And then it came to flying home. And I mean, I was in such a bad way. We had to travel by car and it was very bumpy. You know, my headache, I can't even explain. It's like my brain was going to explode. I pressured in my head. I felt sick. I had tears rolling down my cheeks. And actually, a flight attendant came over and, you know, was asking what was going on. And Alex managed to say, you know, oh, she's fine. I think he said we had an argument. I can't remember what he said. And so we got on the plane, came home. But then kind of things went from bad to worse over the next 6 weeks. And yeah, 18 months later, it has been really life changing.
Yeah. So you got back and you underreported it, didn't it? So you were sort of playing it down.
Yeah, I got back and, well, for the first probably 4 weeks, I really was unwell. I couldn't really leave a darkened room. I was, bedbound. I couldn't tolerate light or noise or sound. I could get myself up to the bathroom and I could, you know, make a slice of toast. Luckily, you know, Alex was great and was around. But then hockey had restarted and, you know, my character, I was not going to be missing. I was going to miss as little as possible. I couldn't be there for the first 2 weeks. I wasn't well enough. And I started to think, oh, maybe I can go in. And I went back in. And yes, I definitely underreported. I think it's kind of a mentality of an athlete, like mind over matter, I can beat this. Like, you know, no one can see this. It's just in my head. Like, you know, I'm okay. And I managed to persuade the doctor to let me go to part of an away day. And it was, they were doing some pottery painting. And I obviously hadn't seen I hadn't really seen anyone for over a month. I'd been kind of, as I said, kind of confined at home. And I remember walking into the room, you know, 30 of us girls were very noisy. I remember almost just being hit by this wall of sound, and my brain, I remember being like, it just couldn't take it. I was like, okay, you're fine, just sit down, got an egg cup, and I was chatting to the person next to me, probably about half an hour in, and all like the only way I can describe it is I felt like someone hit me over the back of the head with a hammer. It was like a sharp pain, and then I just couldn't respond. I physically could not talk, and I couldn't get any words to reply to her, and I remember thinking, like, this wave of, like, panic. And I remember thinking, right, just, I went back to my makeup and pretended, because I knew the session finished in about 2 minutes. Session finished. I remember the physio came over, are you okay? Like, I remember welling up. I was like, I need to get home.
Could you reply?
At that point, I could reply. Yes, I could reply at that point. I got home, and that's when things kind of went from bad to worse. I became very, very sick. I had a seizure. I was rushed into hospital. You know, I showed every sign of having some sort of a bleed, had emergency CT scans, MRI. I then went up to Birmingham for a lumbar puncture. And thankfully, there was nothing shown. And I remember the doctor at the time said, look, this is, I've never seen anybody kind of, his exact words were, fall off a cliff quite like this, this long after a head injury. He said, you've got a mild traumatic brain injury and this could take several months to get better. And I just remember looking at him thinking, you don't know me. I'll be fine in a week. Who are you kidding? Like, I'll be fine. And unfortunately, he was probably the closest to being right. I left hospital just over a week later and I could honestly do nothing. I couldn't read a book. I could hardly hold a conversation. I had to have help to the bathroom. Screens were an absolute no. It was almost like my processing ability had just disappeared. And my headaches were very, very bad. And it was back to dark room. You know, it was almost like my body had gone into this physical state of fear. The best way, any noise, it wasn't just that noise was loud. If you've ever experienced being in a car with someone, you think they're going to crash, you get that kind of rush of adrenaline over your body. And it was different to that, but it was almost like my body was always fighting this fear response. Mm-hmm. And so I just felt very unwell. And unfortunately, that was my reality for probably about the next 8-9 months.
Do you know why there was that fear response? Like, has the doctor ever said anything about the similarity between the relationship between brain injury?
So there was one doctor, obviously, we saw many doctors, and one of the kind of slightly terrifying things about head injuries is there is fantastic diagnostics in terms of if there is a bleed, but if there's not, there's very little is actually known. They do think the part of my brain that I hit, my amygdala, is where your fight and flight hormone is released. So if there's some damage there or some bruising or anything there, that can have effect in how your body regulates your fear response. So, you know, that was one of the really unpleasant symptoms and meant that, you know, anything busy or noisy or where anybody was just an act. I couldn't tolerate it. My body just simply couldn't tolerate it. It was like I just had to get out of the room. So, you know, that was probably one of the symptoms that has now gone that I am the most thankful for, because having been somebody that was, you know, I was leading my country out at a home World Cup in front of, you know, 20,000 people 3 weeks before, to not being able to hold a conversation with Alex or my mum was incredibly difficult.
Yeah, to go from resilient to having this fearful, fearful.
And I couldn't understand it. And I've always been someone that nothing's beating me, you know. I can beat that time frame. I can get better quickly, you know, mind over matter, I can do this. But head injuries are not like that. And the really hard thing about them is they are invisible. So the only thing that anybody else can see is what the person tells you. That's it. You know, there's no visible signs for my type of head injury. So when it's a mild traumatic brain injury, of course, thankfully it wasn't a traumatic brain injury where there are, you know, sometimes really visible signs. But many people have this and it's very, very hard for people to understand.
Was the loss of control then, was that one of the hardest things?
I think for me it was the loss of identity and the loss of purpose. my life has been filled with hockey, with being a part of a team, with training every day, with seeing people, with having real purpose. And I also really enjoyed the leadership role that I held in the team as captain. It was one that I was very proud of, and I was very connected to people. And literally overnight, I couldn't hold a conversation. So my connectivity with the team stopped overnight. I wasn't able to continue with any sort of work. And, you know, I sat on the board at the Commonwealth Games, and that was something I loved doing. I wasn't able to do that. I wasn't able to keep in touch with friends. So it was definitely the isolation and the not being able to stay connected and not be able to explain to people why, because I wasn't well enough. So it was almost like this vicious circle of probably nothingness to anybody else around me.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
I know that you gave a talk fairly recently about mental health, or a sort of mental health talk or whatever. And I know that, you know, previously haven't really struggled in that way. Did your mental health suffer during this period? I mean, it must have done.
Yeah, it's a really interesting one. And as when I was at my worst, I was always asked, how is your mental health? And I found it, if I'm honest, I found it very, very hard, because you can't see it. It wasn't a mental health problem, but it was a head injury that resulted in poor mental health because I couldn't do anything. So it was two very separate things. But yes, looking back now, even though I said my mental health is fine, I'm physically unwell. And I used to almost argue with a doctor, if you were living the life I was leading, I challenge you to have good mental health. But it's not a mental health problem. It's a physical injury that's making how you feel tough. And I probably fought it. But I look back now and there were some really dark moments. But it was dark in that I was just petrified I wasn't going to get well. And I was actually petrified that I'd been misdiagnosed, because I couldn't believe that anybody, you know, you're right. And I will say this about myself, I'm very resilient. Not much stops me. And this just stopped me in my tracks. And I couldn't believe that people could go through this and there not be something that someone can see, or some sort of injury that you can pinpoint and say, okay, this is what it is, this is when you're going to get better. No one knew. And so my husband Alex he used to make me say pretty much every morning, I am getting better, I will get better, I'm going to make a full recovery. And I used to get so cross with him, because he'd like, say it, and I would be like, I don't want to. He said, say it. And he's like, I am getting better, I will get better, I will make a full recovery. And he was relentlessly positive. He was relentlessly believed that I would get well. And actually, I look at that now, and that was such an important part of my journey, because for months, every day, I didn't have a moment of feeling well.
Yeah.
So it was really important that I had that kind of, yeah, good voice in my ear saying that I would. And that definitely helped.
I think I've read somewhere as well that you said as well, you need your mind to tell your body that it's getting better.
So right? My belief system's changed enormously over the last year and a half, because I feel like I've experienced my health at its poorest that I've ever experienced. And I believe that your mind and your body are inextricably linked, without a shadow of a doubt. If your mind is telling your body it's poorly, or your mind is telling your body it is useless, or your mind is telling your body you can't do something, your body will listen. And so I have, whether it has been self-talk, whether it has been breathing, whether it's been out in nature, and all things where if I'd heard myself say this probably a year and a half ago, I would have laughed at myself. Like, what is she saying? Mm. But you learn to look for other things to make yourself well. So, yeah, how I even, after probably about 5 months of having this head injury, Alex and I stopped talking about it in the house. He stopped asking me, because in asking me, he's reinforcing that I'm still not well. So it was just slight changes in behaviour that, so it became something I was managing as opposed to something I was suffering with. I remember speaking to one lady, and she said to me, she was a neuropsychologist, and I was very nervous about seeing her, if I'm honest, because I was like, I don't need to see a psychologist. I've hit my head. It's not what I'm thinking. And I was like, okay, fine, I'll go, because I'll try anything. And she said to me that pain is inevitable, but suffering is optional. And if I'm honest, I remember looking at her and thinking, yeah, but you're not suffering, so it's easy for you to say that. But actually, she's really right. Like, pain for all of us is inevitable in every walk of life, in many, many different manifestations. Mm-hmm. It's life, and it's the horrible part of life. But how we deal with that is optional. So rather than telling myself every day, this is awful and how am I going to get through it, I was starting to tell myself, I've walked to the end of the garden today. I've held a conversation with mum, and I just changed my internal dialogue. And I know that that has helped my recovery, and I know that it's got me to this point.
So that's the Buddhist mantra, isn't it? I think pain is inevitable, but suffering is not. So
is it? I didn't know that.
It's interesting. Sports psychology and Buddhism. Yeah.
As I said, at the time, I wanted to throttle the lady sat opposite me, but she was right.
Yeah.
And it's something that I've used a lot even more recently. You know, we do have a choice about how we respond to things. It doesn't mean it's easy. It doesn't mean it comes naturally, but we do always have a choice.
Yeah. So your support network, clearly, or like Alex, your mm-hmm. other half, being definitely a bit of a hero, despite obviously landing you in it in the first place.
Yeah, those terrible jokes.
But, you know, you've had a lot of people who've really helped you through the period, haven't you?
Yes.
So, you know, yeah, just talk to me about the gratitude you feel then towards your support network and you know, who did what and stuff like that.
I think when something happens, you find out who your warriors are. You find out exactly who's, you know, on your team and in your corner. And there's just no way in this world I would have got through the last 2 years had it not been for my family. You know, my mum and my dad are just quite incredible human beings. Mm. My sister, you know, she used to get up and train at 4 a.m. so she could be with me when I woke up in the morning and just lie in bed with me for a couple of hours. And then she'd change her working hours so that she could be with me. My brother, you know, he used to call mum every day because I couldn't take the calls. I just knew they're always there. And, you know, they'd come and see me. I've got two young nephews, and my poor nephews had to be in silent any time they came. You know, I just have a wonderful family. And then your friendship network, and I think the sports network, it's small and it's close, and everybody understands what living in this environment means. So people reaching out, and it was, whether it was an email or a phone call. As I said, what's been really challenging is for really up until now, and we're, 18 months since I hit my head, I haven't been able to reply to anything, really very little, because of the nature of my injury and my health. So it will be now over the next, you know, period of time where I'm able to get back and say, you made an enormous difference to me. Even though I couldn't get back to you at the time, it lifted me on that day, or it helped me make a good decision. And then I had, you know, those friends that right from the start, you know, pretty much planned my wedding, did it for me, you know, did my hen do, you know, communicated with doctors, all of these things that my friends just went above and beyond. And I'll be forever thankful.
Yeah. And the organisations as well, because I know obviously you're in a fortunate position being an elite athlete.
Yeah.
You know, having all these people sort of step up.
You are really fortunate, but nothing's a given. Mm-hmm. So I think of two in particular, and there are others, but if I say these two in particular, hockey have been absolutely fabulous. And our sponsors, Investec, have been just far more than that. You know, the human connection I have with both of those organisations has been quite incredible, because they care. And when you feel cared for, it helps your health. It makes you feel like you weren't just a person in a system. You're not just a person in an organisation. And they've been absolutely enormous in my support right from the start and right to the end. And I very much look forward to this next period of time being able to say thank you appropriately, because that's not a given in life. And as I said, you really, really do work out who's in your team.
A lot of people can feel like a number or, just another person in an organisation. So were you surprised then by the way they stepped up?
No, because of the working relationship I think I had with them before. And, you know, Investec are a very people-facing company. We know them. We know them by name. You know, we have had an enormous, a very long relationship with them at hockey, and I'm also, I work with them personally as well. So, no, I wasn't surprised. But it doesn't make it any, you know, less amazing, because you're not surprised. And people do surprise you. They surprise you both ways. And again, with hockey, my relationship there has been for 18 years, and I would consider them friends over colleagues, many of them. And I think the thing that was incredibly useful is everybody knows my character. My goodness, if I could have been on the pitch, I would have been on the pitch. Mm-hmm. Therefore, even though I had something that was invisible, they were very understanding and they were very supportive. And even though, you know, we weren't, at times I had to look further afield in terms of support to get well, they were always there helping. Mm-hmm. And that was enormous.
Being valued by the where you work, in your case, is pretty different to most people's, but it does make a huge difference. So many people don't feel like that, and it makes a huge difference to, you know, considering how much time one spends at work.
Oh, I was actually at, and this is, when you say the workplace, I have a fantastic relationship with a company called Hendy, and I've always wondered why they've been so good to me. Very like Investec. Why have they been so good to me? And then I heard the owner of Hendy speak, and he talked about looking after his people, being a family, being connected, and every single one of you matter. And that is why, because they look after people.
And it makes such a difference, that kind of attitude.
They do. Huge. And they just, and it makes you feel, as you say, valued and part of a team and part of something bigger. And when you feel valued and part of a team and part of something bigger, you're in a pretty special community.
Yeah, absolutely. And you said that people reacted, some would react in a way that you wouldn't expect, positively and vice versa. Yeah, so were you surprised by that?
Yeah, as I said, you're almost sometimes surprised both ways. So incredibly positively. And then sometimes this is where I had to manage my expectations. I've spoken to you earlier on in the podcast saying I'd never had expectations, but then something when this, like this does happen because of fabulous friendships you have, you do have slight expectations. Now, the thing that's made this really difficult is I've not been able to communicate with people because I wasn't well enough. So, you know, there has definitely been instances where I've wished for more or hoped for more, but I was never able to go and ask why, or is everything going on with, you know, what's going on in your life? Or so it's far more complex than, you know, just being disappointed. And I much prefer to focus on, as I said, the absolute rock stars that are relentlessly by your side. And that's how I've chosen to deal with it.
Friendships and finding out who your real friends are, that's been a real valuable lesson then for you, because often you don't quite know, I guess.
Yeah, I think you don't quite know, but yeah, you really know when something happens, you really know who's in your corner. And I also think it forms a really enduring friendship. Mm-hmm. And also it connects people. So even if I think to Alex and Michael, you know, Alex knew all of my friends, but he didn't know anyone at hockey. He didn't know anyone at Vestek. He now knows everybody, because he had to be my poor Alex, my driver, my, you know, talking to people. He had to communicate to the medical team, he had to organise everything for me. So it's also connected all of my friendship groups and my family, which is actually being really special, because that group of people now will be far closer moving forward. So there's been lots and lots of positive things as well.
Clearly your value system's changed a bit. I feel like I'm landing you slightly in it, but you were talking about, obviously you got married recently, mm-hmm. but perhaps you might have put that off until...
I'm really sorry if you listen to this, Alex. Yeah, I said that we totally wouldn't have got married until after Tokyo. Maybe you would, who knows? I think it would have been unlikely because, you know, Alex is very focused on work. I'm very focused on hockey, and you know, you hardly have time to go on holiday, let alone plan a wedding. So, you know, I can't say for certain, but yeah, I do joke.
Yeah, hunch.
This, I do joke that this head injury has given me, you know, yeah, a great perspective and a husband. Yeah. And yeah, of course, we would have got married, I'm sure, at some point. But it definitely makes you realise, you know, your health really is everything. And I remember when I was, you know, at my absolute worst, the only person I wanted by my side was Alex. Mm-hmm. Like, he was the only person that made me feel, you know, made me feel okay. And when you spend that much time with somebody and that one, and that person is doing so much for you, I think it probably makes or breaks. And for us, it was a case of probably, yeah, accelerating that relationship, but only because hockey probably wasn't in the way, because it was going that way anyway.
Yeah.
But yeah, it definitely, and to get married was incredibly special. I mean, never has a wedding been changed so many times. Mm. But it was incredibly special, and my commitment is still to my sport, but it's just given me a much broader appreciation for what's really, really important in life.
So how would you sum up how your value system has been altered by what you've been through?
God, that's a good question in terms of summing it up succinctly. I think I look back and you could definitely question my balance before my head injury. My balance was hockey. You know, I was the athlete. I never missed a thing. Every waking thought was about competing, and my family and Alex and were very, very understanding. Of course, they've always been incredibly important to me, but hockey was always the thing for me. But I think since I hit my head, it's made me realise how fragile life can be, how something can change in an absolute moment, and actually how, you know, fundamental your relationships are to being happy. And actually, when something changes in the moment, there's some things that don't ever change, and they're generally the people around you. And I think that's just given me a much broader outlook on life. And whereas, as I said, hockey is still incredibly important to me, my family is my number one. Alex is my number one. Those things just become even...
Health.
Health is... You have nothing without your health. And this last year and a half has really taught me that.
It's very common, I think, definitely very common for people to put work at the top of their mm-hmm. priority tree. And you were living your passion, but yeah. I mean, anyone can learn from that it's not the most important thing.
It's really tricky, isn't it? Because it was for me mm-hmm. and it is for many people, but it's just being able to remember that there are other things and those things contribute to you doing well.
Of course.
So the better you look after those things, it doesn't mean that you're... And that's where I am now. So my family, my relationships, my friendships, my, you know, having some time away, they contribute to me being a better athlete rather than always thinking they were fighting with it. And I think, again, that's just the way you think about something. So I now think about it more differently. Okay, I'm choosing to do this, but that's going to support me to be a better athlete in a different way.
You said that you're... not who you were, and we touched on some of the aspects, clearly your value mm-hmm. system changing and being a bit more open and stuff, but yeah, how would you say you are different now than you were when you were captain?
I think particularly when I was captain, I was very methodical. I would probably overthink everything. I would spend every waking hour thinking, okay, what can I do to help the team move forward, what can I do to be a better player, what can I do? And I think I was like every human being. Like, I worried about what other people thought. I worried that, you know, this may be perceived in this way. And actually, I mean, most of the time it's not. I've realised that most of the time people just aren't thinking because everyone's got their own things to do.
Yeah.
And actually, I'm the last thing on their thought on the day, or how I've said something in a meeting. No one actually cares. And I used to spend so much energy thinking about what others thought. I honestly just don't now. I have much more confidence in my conviction about what I'm doing and it being the right thing with the right intention. And there's just more important things. And I think if we worried less about what others thought and had a bit more, you know, self-care, a bit more trust in what we're saying and why we're saying it and what we were doing and why we were doing it, we'd just saves so much energy. And I think it's definitely made me a more relaxed about things. Mm. It's made me enjoy some things more, silly things. I don't think I'd had a bath ever until I hit my head, and I suddenly had time, and I've learned the relative merits of having a bath. It's calm. You have time to yourself. It's thinking time. You're relaxing. I didn't have time to do any of those things. You know, I used to go for a walk. I'd walk 100 miles an hour because I didn't have time to go for a walk. And I didn't need to go for a walk. Now I walk slowly. I hear things I'd never heard in my life before. I see things that I'd never seen. And it all may sound a bit airy-fairy, but it's definitely helped. It's helped me as a person. It's just made me much calmer and much more relaxed, and I have more time for the important things.
So you're more present?
Significantly more present. And I mean, Alex jokes about it. I don't think he thought I was even on this planet before, and now I'm here. Mm-hmm. And that definitely happened.
You said that you were determined to take the good from this, and I can hear that you've been able to do that. Have you even become, to some degree, grateful for what happened or not?
So here's another story. So a dear friend sent me a text message probably 2 months into my head injury, and she said, "Alex, you're not going to know this now, but this is a gift." She was another one and wanted to go and tear her head off. I was like, who are these people with all these wonderful things? I was like, she was completely right. I have definitely got to the stage now where my life is infinitely better now in terms of balance, in terms of time I spend with people, in terms of appreciating things. I have said for a while now, it was the worst, best thing that's ever happened to me, because my outlook is so very different. The time I spend with people is so very different, and it's just slowed me down. And I was determined I would. I think I said very early, it is in my character. I would take more than this than Nick would take from me. And it took an enormous amount. But I'm at a point now where I'm incredibly happy. I'm getting well. I'm back in the environment I love. I'm married. I'm seeing my family more regularly. And lots of things have gone on, but I still feel that way. Mm. So again, that becomes the choice. So yeah, my friend was right. It was in its own very strange way, something of a gift.
What have you learned about being open and being vulnerable? Because clearly, as you said, you underreported it. Mm-hmm. You were someone who wouldn't want to show weakness. But during the course of your recovery, you actually had to write a letter to the rest of your teammates. So yeah, what have you learned there?
It's tough, like being really open and allowing yourself to be vulnerable isn't easy. In fact, particularly the environment I've been brought up in, it's, you know, I don't show weakness. You know, I don't give any sign that I'm not okay because I'm competing and I'm strong and I'm an athlete and I'm this. And the one thing I learned, particularly with a head injury, is it is invisible. You can't see it. So even now, I look fine. I sound fine. I have a headache. It's background and I can tolerate it. It's not a problem. But when I was at my worst, I probably didn't look, I'm not saying I look good, but I probably didn't look as I do now, but you couldn't see it. And I got to a phase, probably, I think it was about 7 or 8 months, where I wanted to try and return to some form of normality. I wanted to try and come back into Bisham where we train. And I recognised that I couldn't do that. I couldn't expect people to understand what I was going through until I told them, because they can't see it. So I wrote a letter, and, you know, it basically detailed the life that I was living and what they may see. So if they saw it, they could help me. So it was simple things like, please understand that if a conversation becomes too much or noises become too loud, I'll have to leave. So again, they didn't think, oh, Alex is being rude, she's halfway and she's off. They understood that actually the noise level was too high, or I couldn't follow that conversation because my processing speed wasn't as quick, so I'd have to leave the environment. I said, if you see me with headphones in, you know, I'm not being rude, I'm listening to a guided meditation to try and help my headache subside. I told them that white days, so white cloudy days, are much worse for my headaches than sunny blue. So they just had a real understanding of the kind of symptoms I went through. And therefore, I could ask for their help. And I mean, goodness, if there isn't a good lesson I've learned there, is it's okay to ask for help. But in asking for help, you have to explain what you need. I think as humans, we are very caring. We want to support, but you can't support if you don't know what you are supporting. And you know, as I move forward in life, I will never be afraid again to say how I'm doing and be authentic and honest, because it's amazing how people respond. The team were incredible. You know, I was well looked after. You know, bright lights were turned off when I went into a room, and I felt okay about it. Mm. It was the best thing I did.
A number of people I've spoken to who've gone through various things that have led them to being more open and vulnerable have found that as a result they've become more sensitive and more in touch with their emotions. Has that been the case with you?
Oh, I was really sensitive anyway.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I think I've actually probably gone the other way.
Really?
I don't know. That's interesting.
So you said you were sensitive, yet you had perhaps this you know, tough exterior.
Oh, very.
So that perhaps they've become a bit more aligned, have they?
Yeah, potentially, I think, more aligned. I think I've always cared. You could even argue over cared sometimes, which has led to, you know, that kind of sensitive side. But yes, I've become much more comfortable with showing that.
Yes,
I think that's
right.
And particularly with your nearest and dearest, because at time I didn't have any other option but to get upset or, you know, ask, am I ever going to get well? Or, you know, I needed that reassurance. You know, I never. Completely wrongly, I was the captain of the team, so I felt I can't be the one to ask for help. I need to be helping you. And that's wrong. That's not a captain's role. A captain's role is not to not ask for help. They're not the finished product. We don't have all the answers. You're just there to lead authentically, and actually showing your emotions is authentic.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I am much more comfortable in doing that now and saying to people, yeah, I'm doing really well, or actually, yeah, no, today's not so good.
Were you able to, or did you use any of the strategies you learned in becoming an elite sports person to help you deal with what you went through?
I could probably write a book that would be...
Publishers listening.
Identical. Yeah. almost identical, to the point where, you know, I wrote a journal at the start, and I couldn't write, so I'd just draw like a cup and I'd shade it. I basically wanted to get myself to a full cup, and that was 100% health, and it was like I'd shade like 10% for months, and it got so depressing I think I stopped. But you know, I was trying to track my progress, so that really helped, because I could look back and say, okay, that's how I was feeling, this is what I was doing now. I learned to put a new team of people around me. You know, athletes are only athletes because of the support system they have, and my support system had to change because what I needed was different. So in my athletic world, I'd learn how to do that. I'd learn how to find the right people. I'd learn how to work with those people, and I had to do the same when I was injured and when I had this head injury. So there was many things that were very, very similar that I spoke to you earlier on. I did believe I would always get well. It was challenged, and some days that was harder than others, but I essentially had a goal, which was to get to full health. And that's, you know, getting to full health was at the same level as, you know, when I was healthy, of winning an Olympic gold. It was, you know, setting a goal that you were trying to get to bit by bit. So I think there was so much from my sport, you know, from my sport I was able to carry over.
And your family have been through an incredible amount, not just with you as well, because obviously, so your sister was a very successful triathlete, and she was involved in an accident that's left her paraplegic. Crikey, I mean, you guys have really been through it, haven't you?
Yeah, it hasn't been. It's obviously 2019. We were very happy to kind of draw a close on 2019. My sister had a horrific accident in August last year, and she was in intensive care for a number of weeks, general hospital, and she's now in Salisbury Spinal Unit, where she gets specialist care to help with her rehabilitation. And again, I think that's what I talk about, all of us changing, I think, and all of us having a new perspective. I mean, what Claire's going through and how she is dealing with that challenge is quite simply unbelievable.
Mm.
You know, it is so enormously life-changing. Not being able to walk is terrible, and there are many other things you have to deal with that, I'll be honest, you know, we didn't even know as a family. Your bowel care, your bladder care, your skin care, body temperature, blood pressure. There are so many things that now on a day-to-day basis Claire has to learn. So again, it just puts things into perspective, and us all having the things that we do and bringing them to the table, and that's really, really important. But your focus changes, and it very much has been over the last 5 months, all of us, to support Claire.
You had a nice quote, which is learning that every moment as a hockey player, or even just in life, is a gift. Is that really, that's obviously been really brought home?
Yeah, I think, again, you just never know, the click of a finger, when something might change. And I can't tell you how thankful I am. I live my career, and I have lived my career in the way that I've lived it. I don't have one regret. I was the best athlete. I am the best athlete that I can be, and I was pre-injury, and that's how I'm trying to be now. And it's just appreciate the moments that you have, because you don't know when they will not be there. And in our family, we've had to learn in the hardest way through two separate instances that you just don't know when that might change. And yes, it has changed. And in this particular moment, in the darkest moments for me, it was really tough. And in this particular moment for Claire, it is incredibly tough. And I will never take away how enormous going through a spinal cord injury is for anybody. But I also know that because of Claire's character and because of how we are as a family, she will be okay. There will be, you know, sport is a saviour. She will get back into that. I have zero doubt. Her mindset that she learned as an athlete, that will support her. And the decisions we now make and I now make as an individual and as a family have definitely changed, because we have learned, yeah, authentically what is the most important thing in life, and that's each other and family and your health.
I was just about to say, so what? Yeah, what's the key takeaway, the key things you've learned? So is that it? Or, yeah, what if you were putting you on the spot here?
So what I've really learned is, if you don't do something with all you'll have, you'll never know. You'll never know what you can achieve. So I have always lived that way. I'm living that way now. You know, I'm coming back, because if I don't, I'll never know. You never know if you don't try. So that, for me, is the undercurrent for everything. Give it a go. Mm. If you don't, you never write your final chapter. Mm. And then, I guess even stronger than that, or the thing that supports that, is the people around you appreciating what you have, having that strong family network, having that strong friendship network, and looking after your health. Like, looking after yourself. You have to look after yourself to be able to look after others. And, yeah, this year has definitely taught us that in abundance.
So giving it a go, and therefore not having any regrets.
Yeah, live with no regrets. And if you can live with no regrets, then whatever happens, you can't look back and say, what if?
Just before I let you go, so where are you at with the... Obviously, we got Tokyo in the horizon. Mm-hmm. It's coming up fast. I know you're just back with the squad, so... and obviously, they want your acrobatic goal scoring skills back to call upon. So yeah, where are you at with your hockey?
So I've returned to Bishan with the team, which has been, it's just been such a joy to be back in an environment I've been in for 18 years, colleagues and friends that, you know, it's been fabulous. I'm very much at the early stages of return in terms of trying to push my physical activity. I still get, as I said, very bad headaches, so it's very much balancing a return to play with managing my symptoms. So I'm very much day by day. I believe that returning will support my health, and if my health gets better, it gives me the best opportunity to play. So I don't have a, this is where I need to be at this date. I'm much more health orientated, because if I'm healthy, I'll be able to play.
Alex, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on Don't Tell Me the Score.
Thank you very much.
We've hit the, we're 5, 4, 3. Yeah, we've hit the hour mark. So I told
Amazing.
You. Fly
thank
by. You. Yeah, anyway, thank you very much for coming on.
Pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for listening to this episode of Don't Tell Me the Score. I really hope you enjoyed our conversation. And I would, of course, be delighted to hear your thoughts, ideas, and questions. Do get in touch via my website, simonmundy.com. I do really appreciate you listening, and if you could leave a kind rating and review, I would be sincerely grateful. All that remains is for me to say I hope you'll join me again next time. Until then, thank you and goodbye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.